Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Let's say you're one of the thousands, if not millions, of Americans on a popular low-carb diet, a lunch of spray cheese, beef jerky sticks, and diet soda. It only sets you back 5 carbs. Better than a bowl of rice and vegetables, right? This week, the answer might be yes, and next week, the answer might be no. Joining us now is the founder of the Yale Prevention Research Center and author of the book Disease Proof. He joins us by phone from Connecticut. Welcome back to the show, Dr. David Katz.
Thank you, Ann. Pleasure to be with you.
You recently co-published a paper titled, Can We Say What Diet Is Best for Health? Why that question in the first place?
Well, I think it's obvious, and your intro, I think, hints at the reason why. The journal actually came to me. This is a journal that publishes peer-reviewed papers that review what we know. The name of the journal is Annual Review in Public Health, so it's important themes in public health. This is a huge theme in public health. There's no debating that food is the fuel that runs the human machine. It reverberates throughout every organ system. It has implications for both years in life and life in years. I think everybody agrees on that. So questions about what's good to eat are enormously important to public health, and one could, in fact, argue they're among the most important questions in modern public health where we suffer from obesity and diabetes. And just as you said, you know, we hear today, you know, we should be on the grapefruit diet, and tomorrow we should be on the no-fruit diet, and the next day we should be on the pickle juice diet, and, you know, on and on it goes. And frankly, we just keep fiddling while Rome burns. And in this case, the burning is the development of diabetes in as many as 1 in 3 Americans within a generation. We're staring down the barrel of that gun. This is serious business. So, you know, I was pleased when the journal said, look, you seem to be someone who looks at this from altitude. You've written textbooks on nutrition. You don't have a dog in the fight. You're not trying to, you know, sell a particular diet. Are you willing to review the literature dispassionately and reach a conclusion on this topic? And I said, if I may put it bluntly, hell yeah.
Did you reach a conclusion?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the issue is this. The basic theme of healthful eating is absolutely clear, incontrovertible in my opinion, and it's based on intervention studies, randomized trials, transcultural comparisons, studies spanning decades in every population around the world. And it's a diet, you know, as best we can get there, of real foods, mostly plants. If it glows in the dark, step away from the box and nobody will get hurt. And if you eat wholesome foods, and that would be vegetables, fruits, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, yes, I think whole grains are in the mix, and then with or without, poultry, fish, seafood, lean meats, dairy, eggs, I mean, all of those things are more discretionary and they can be in or out. But all of the nutrients we debate all the time, sugar and salt and saturated fat and all of the nutrients in the superfoods, antioxidants, they all take care of themselves. You eat a wholesome diet, and by and large, the nutrients sort themselves out. But where the answer is no, and so, you know, can we say what diet is best for health? The basic theme, absolutely yes. The specific variant on the theme that's best, absolutely no. Can we say for sure that an optimal vegan diet is better for human health than an optimal Mediterranean diet? We can't. Can we say that either of those is better than an optimal paleo-style diet? We can't. Can we say that any of those is better than an optimal Asian diet or low-fat diet or, you know, on the list could go? No, as long as you stay on the reservation, stick to the theme, we can't answer those questions. I don't think we ever will be able to for the following reason. Definitive proof that an optimal vegan diet produces better lifelong health outcomes, say, than an optimal Mediterranean diet, would basically require randomly assigning neonates to one of those two dietary patterns and following them for the next 100 years. You know, I don't see that happening anytime soon. So, you know, when you look at the evidence we do have, it argues so eloquently for a basic theme of healthful eating. And here's my point, and thank you for this opportunity, because I will preach this every chance I get. Let's use what we know. As a preventive medicine specialist looking on at this unending My Diet Can Beat Your Diet beauty pageant and the unending parade of fad diet bestsellers, I think we're frittering away years of life and life in years debating what we don't know, debating the My Diet Can Beat Your Diet, you know, icing, and ignoring the cake. We could act on what we do know and eliminate up to 80% of all chronic disease right now. Let's do that first and then debate the rest.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. David Katz, founder of the Yale Prevention Research Center and the author of the book Disease Proof. We're talking about an article he published or a paper he published recently in the Annual Review of in public in Public Health or of Public Health. It's titled, Can We Say What Diet Is Best for Health? If you have a question or comment about your diet you'd like to run by Dr. Katz, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said that it's not really about things like vitamins and minerals and sugar and fat and that sort of a thing, but we do know sugar is a huge problem in our diet, and that's because we eat so much processed food.
Exactly.
And sugar is included in processed food, and you and I have talked about this before,
right,
to make it taste better if it doesn't have as much fat in it, or to make it taste bitter if it doesn't have as much sodium in it, or whatever.
Yeah, but more to it than that. And actually, the insidious part, Dan, is something called sensory-specific satiety. And actually, I have my latest column for U.S. News and World Report, people can find online, is on this topic. You know, everybody overeats an all-you-can-eat buffet. I think everybody knows that. And so, you know, it's time to reorient, because where's the bargain? You know, you get fat at no extra charge and then can spend a fortune to lose the weight that you gain for free. So it's sort of time to wake up and smell the Slim Fast, people. But the reason we overeat at an all-you-can-eat buffet is because variety is a goad to appetite. It's the way the human appetite center is hardwired. The PhDs working for the big food companies know this, and so they put sugar in pasta sauce. They put sugar in salty foods, even sometimes in chips, but certainly in crackers. And they do the converse. They put salt in things like breakfast cereal at very high levels, often more concentrated than it is in potato chips. All of that, whether you taste it or not, is acting on your hypothalamus and it making you eat more. So absolutely, I mean, we eat too much sugar, we eat too much salt. But if you eat more wholesome foods, mm-hmm, not only does it cut out the sugar, cut out the salt, cut out the trans fat, cut down on the calories, it allows you to fill up on fewer calories, because you're taking away that influence of sort of, you know, an engineered aspect of food that stimulates us to eat more than we should. And we've heard about that from people like Michael Moss, who has his book out, Salt, Sugar, Fat, and wrote a New York Times Magazine cover story about the addictive properties of junk food. It's not by accident, it's by design. But if we eat the right kinds of foods, we can fight back.
And a lot of that goes to having to prepare the right kinds of foods. People don't seem as willing to do that as they used to. A lot of people don't even know how to cook.
Exactly right. So, and you mentioned kindly at the beginning my book, Disease Proof. Really, that's what the book is about. It's about skill power for getting there from here. I have it because I'm supposed to. This is my expertise. Everybody can get it. But we have to take health and weight control a bit more seriously. You know, I mean, basically, we don't expect to get rich quick. We expect to work and manage our money. We can work and manage our health. There is some effort involved, but the return on investment is huge. But I agree with you completely, Ann. The issue really is people don't know how to get there from here. We can address that, both individually and collectively, but we don't focus on addressing that until or unless we agree on where there is. So my very point is, as long as we keep debating, you know, this week we cut fat, next week we add back butter, the week after we cut out all grains because, you know, they're giving us dementia and making us fat. I mean, if we keep bopping around like a ping pong ball, we never agree on the destination. It may be hard to get where you want to go even after you all agree where you want to go. There's no way to get where you want to go until you agree where you want to go. And I'm saying we do know. We are not clueless about the basic care and feeding of Homo sapiens. The theme of healthful eating is clear. Let's embrace it. And then we can take on the challenge of all the things we need to do to get there from here.
The more we know about genetics, to what extent does that affect how much we know about how diet affects different people differently? I know there's some things I can't eat because it affects me.
Right.
I have a sensitivity to it. And doctors won't necessarily tell me that.
So two answers. First, three, actually. First, it's quite important. We know that genes matter. Second, we're really in the age of epigenetics now. And so, you know, there was a thinking when we first fell in love with the genome that DNA was destiny. It's really not. To a far greater extent, dinner is destiny. The things we do that influence our health, our behavior, influence the expression of our very genes, can alter what our DNA does. And so really, behavior is much more destiny than DNA. And then the third answer is, I imagine, Anne, that there is significant genetic variation among koala bears. I haven't made a study of it, but, you know, no two koala bears are identical. But they're all koala bears. And you know, we look at them and think, well, gee, that's important. Koala bears eat eucalyptus leaves because they're koala bears. Now, I would argue we are a species, too. The basic theme of healthful living for our species is what we have in common. And then the variations on that theme is where things like nutrigenomics come in. And absolutely, there are variations on the theme, which was the very finding in our paper. The theme of healthful eating is clear. The specific variant that's best is not clear. And that's a beautiful thing because it allows you to customize the theme to suit your genes, if you're so inclined and have the information, but minimally your preferences. Because, you know, I think the sweet spot is loving food that loves us back, getting pleasure from good food and pleasure from good health, and having options gives us the best opportunity for that.
Pam in Clintonville, you're on the air with Dr. David Katz. Hi, Pam.
Good morning, Ann. Yes, I had a question for the doctor. We all know people that physically they don't have any particular major health issues, but yet when they try to cut down on their caloric intake, they simply can't lose weight. And you see that, you were talking about other species, you can see that in dogs. There are some dogs that require very few calories to maintain their weight, certain species of dogs. And I was wondering if there was any thought that there may be something similar genetically in humans that predispose them to have a much harder time to lose weight when they cut back on their caloric intake.
Well, thank you, Pam. Good question. The answer, and I know we're short on time, but absolutely yes. And actually, I have an online resource for that very reason. It's called the National Exchange for Weight Loss Resistance. So if you Google that, you'll find that it's an online forum. And just briefly, first of all, losing weight, gaining it back, that cycle tends to make people weight loss resistant because they tend to lose both fat and muscle and then gain back mostly fat. And as you diet and lose weight, the calories required to maintain your weight go down anyway, so people tend to struggle with weight loss. Some people are uniquely resistant to weight loss. To some extent, that may be genetics. To some extent, it may be other things we're really just beginning to learn about, like the intestinal bacteria. Variation in the microbiome has now been clearly linked to variation in the ease or difficulty with which weight is lost or gained. So we're really just starting to learn about some of those interesting reasons. But still, most people underestimate their calorie intake, overestimate their exercise, and by and large, if we get those things right, if we eat well and control our calorie intake and we're active, most of us will wind up with much better weight. Some of us may still struggle a bit, but you know, the whole population bell curve will move to a better place.
Pam, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. David Katz, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Ann, a pleasure.
Dr. David Katz, he's founder of the Yale Prevention Research Center and author of the book Disease Proof. We'll continue with Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control adjusted the incidence of autism among American children to 1 in 68. That's a 30% increase from just 2 years ago. And researchers on the West Coast recently published a study that shows signs of autism appear during pregnancy, about 4 years before most children are diagnosed. Joining us now by phone to walk us through the implications of these new findings is the executive director of the National Autism Center, Dr. Hannah Rue. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks so much for having me.
You're also vice president of autism services at the May Institute in Randolph, Massachusetts. So you're in the trenches. Do the CDC numbers of 1 in 68 match what you're seeing on the job?
Well, to be honest, you can, over the past decade, you've certainly seen an increase in awareness. And I do think, you know, there is some discussion about 1 in 68 being the actual number. But I think there, without a doubt, is been an increase in awareness and identification of these kids. And yes, we're seeing a number of them coming in for our diagnostics, for treatment, for specialized school settings.
What is the significance? What should we take away from the suggestion that from the study that shows signs of autism appear during pregnancy about 4 years before most children are diagnosed?
I think it's about raising awareness, really. And so, you know, a lot of parents identify issues around lack of eye contact, problems with communication early on. And oftentimes when they bring these concerns to their pediatricians, it can be a wait-and-see type of situation. But what we want to do is we want parents to recognize, you know, these early signs of autism and talk to their medical professional repeatedly about their concerns, as early diagnosis is the best thing that we can do right now in order to get early intervention.
How did they figure out that what the signs of autism were in utero?
Well, what we know is, again, over the past decade, there has been some fantastic research regarding the genetics of autism. We know there's a strong genetic link. And so what this most recent study did was actually take some samples of brain tissue and looked at these disorganized patches of neurons that they identified in the brain area, which essentially control things like social and emotional functioning, communication, and language functioning. So with this brain tissue, they identified in this small sample, I think it was about 11 tissue samples that were provided, that there were consistently areas of disorganized neurons, and they know that these areas actually develop in utero, and so they can actually trace it back to, you know, fetal development.
When you talk about genetic connections, we know that there's Fragile X syndrome, which is one of the only, or one of the few, or the only known cause of autism. It's genetic.
Yeah, we have about 10 to 20% of individuals that can be identified with, for example, like you said, Fragile X, tuberous sclerosis, Angelman syndrome, which leads to a diagnosis of autism. So we oftentimes, when we're doing a full-blown diagnostic assessment, we often advise parents to get some genetic studies completed in order to identify any one of those syndromes or disorders that might be present.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Dr. Hannah Rue. She's the Executive Director of the National Autism Center. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. What do you make of environmental factors that might lead to autism? Is this an issue of environmental factors that affect the parent then and are and that's why it affects the child in utero, or what are the risk factors?
Well, I think there's still a lot to be known. So what we do know from the research are there some identified environmental factors, things like folic acid, parents taking Depakote to control seizures. These have been found to have an impact on autism risks, but there's so much that we don't know. And so I think within the next decade or two, we'll be gathering more information on those environmental risks on the mother, the father, and the child. I think there's still much to be known, but a few things that have identified that I just mentioned.
We mentioned the 1 in 68 number that is being identified by the CDC as far as the number of children with along the autism spectrum. But is it possible, and you said it's probably a reflection of more awareness about the issue, is it possible that a lot of these kids are being misdiagnosed, though, with autism? Maybe they have another condition that's being confused?
That's certainly a possibility, and you know, we've seen that as well. And certainly with the new DSM changes, we're trying as a field to rein that in so that we can have appropriate, specific diagnoses for these kids. But like everything with autism, it's probably a pretty complex answer, you know, with some kids being misdiagnosed or some kids somewhere on the spectrum that haven't yet been identified. I think that's one of the issues, is because it is a spectrum disorder, identification can be challenging because you have some individuals who face quite significant challenges and some individuals who, you know, can go on through adulthood without ever being identified.
It's interesting when you describe the brain cells, you know, being jumbled and what they, you know, the way it sounds like. And yet autism is also can be associated with someone who has a very high IQ.
Oh, absolutely. again, with it being a spectrum disorder, we have some individuals that I've worked with who have unbelievable talents and certain skills around music and art and mathematics, and some individuals who are you know, like Temple Grandin, who is a self-identified individual on the autism spectrum who is unbelievably brilliant in her area of study. So, again, I think that's what poses some challenges, because the spectrum is so broad. Every individual is unique and presents unique strengths.
What age of diagnosis is something that might change following, well, the new study that says, well, the age of diagnosis is something that might change given that study that found evidence that autism develops in the womb. Tell us what kind of impact that can have.
Oh, a tremendous impact. So right now we're still seeing average age of diagnosis around 4 years. However, autism can be diagnosed at age 2. And we have a number of researchers across the country and around the world who are trying to push that back even further to 12 months of age. And so, as I said earlier, as soon as parents see some indication, something amiss with communication and eye contact, you know, speaking with their pediatrician and their physician is really important, because the sooner we can identify these symptoms or behaviors associated with autism, the quicker we can get in with early intervention, and that's what's going to have the biggest impact. We do have research that shows that with early intervention, a well-rounded behavioral program based on evidence-based practices, you can actually see neuronal connections changing in some children's brains. And so that's why we really push for early identification and early intervention.
What kinds of treatments would be offered to very young children, infants with autism, if they are able to diagnose them that young?
Well, that's what's really exciting, is we actually do know what to do when diagnosed early. So that's one of the things that we do at the National Autism Center, is we do identify evidence-based interventions for children and adults. And we do provide free resources, including a parent's manual to evidence-based practice on our website. So what's come out to be some of the most effective interventions includes behavioral interventions based on applied behavior analysis. So you want a well-rounded program that really focuses on teaching communication, teaching social skills, teaching adaptive behaviors that can be, you know, these things can be done in the home setting, in community setting, and in clinics. And you can start that. I've worked with individuals 18 months of age.
If one in 68 children in the United States were being diagnosed with, I can't even begin to say, let's say cancer, let's say rheumatoid arthritis, whatever it might be, mm-hmm. The resources put toward that research would, I can't even imagine how they would jump. How much resources are we putting toward studying this now that we're starting to be much more narrower in what in who qualifies and who's being diagnosed as this, and also as we begin to study the brain and the genetic implications?
Well, I think, you know, having this opportunity, and today does mark World Autism Awareness Day, and so I do think we're raising awareness, because we certainly don't have enough money dedicated to research on treatments and interventions and resources provided to parents. And then, you know, we've just finished a fantastic project looking at resources that are available for adults with autism, which is little to none. And so raising awareness, you know, contacting your legislature, getting involved in the community, and really pushing for more funding, more support for families. We now have over 30 states in the United States that have passed some sort of insurance reform mandate, mm-hmm. So that, you know, some sort of monetary support can be provided to parents so that they can access evidence-based interventions and the professionals they need. But it's certainly with one in 68 it's certainly not enough. And as you make a good point, if it would be 1 in 68 with childhood cancer or something of that nature, you would see a call to action. So hopefully we'll see, especially during this National Autism Awareness Month, more folks paying attention, getting involved, and getting more resources out to our families and practitioners.
Children with autism tend to be overwhelmingly male. According to the CDC report, it's 1 in 42 boys has autism, 4.5 times as many as girls, which is 1 in 189. What do you make of that?
It goes back to the genetics. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, that was one of the first indicators that I think that researchers went to, is that identified more in males. And so taking that, it goes back to the long line of research that indicates that there is a genetic issue here. And so I think, you know, having more males diagnosed is just one indicator of that.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything particularly in our culture, the way we view boys, that affects our ability to diagnose them earlier than girls?
Well, you know, that's interesting. What we see in the literature is it's not necessarily a gender, you know, a gender issue that helps us with identification or lack of identification, but it's a cultural ethnicity issue. We're seeing individuals from lower socioeconomic levels, from diverse cultural and racial backgrounds that are actually getting diagnosed later. And so those individuals have later diagnosis, and then it takes longer for them to access evidence-based practice. So not necessarily gender, but I would look at some of the other factors that impact early identification.
If autism does develop in the womb, if it turns out that's the way it works or can work in some cases, does that suggest that treatment could begin in the womb?
You know, possibly. There are some extraordinary things that are happening, for example, in the Boston area, where you have a autism consortium of a phenomenal group of researchers at Harvard, MIT, who are doing extraordinary cutting-edge research to look into the genetic factors and what's happening prenatally. So it wouldn't surprise me, you know, within the next 20 years if we identify something that could be done. As it stands right now, we don't know of anything that can be done prenatally, as opposed, you know, with the exception being taking good health measures or whatnot, as you speak with your doctor. But we do know about what can be done once a child is identified early on, and that's the evidence-based interventions based on behavior analysis.
The incidence of autism changes across the country. The incidence of autism is 1 in 175 children in Alabama to a high, well, I guess that's the low, and to a high of 1 in 45 in New Jersey, according to the CDC again. To what extent? I mean, do you think it could be something like all the chemicals in our society, all the unchecked use of chemicals, really?
Well, and certainly I think that's one of the environmental variables that researchers are looking into, you know, how these various chemicals and toxins in the environment can impact our health and well-being and can possibly impact autism. One of the things to consider when reviewing that latest CDC study is the authors do indicate some limitations in that study, in that because they are looking at 11 specific areas within the country, that those specific areas may not necessarily be representative of that state or even the United States as a whole. And so that's one of the issues that we see with this type of epidemiological study, is that it is concentrated into 11 specific areas in the country. And so, you know, as research evolves and gets more sophisticated, hopefully we'll get better about making confirming identification of the number of kids across the country with this disorder.
The diagnosis of Asperger's has been removed and has been just blended into the spectrum, the autism spectrum disorder category. Have you seen any ramifications from that?
Well, yes, certainly most coming from the Asperger's community. And so we have a number of individuals with a diagnosis of Asperger's who identify with that group, who identify with this diagnosis and You know, you see phenomenal support groups and individuals who, you know, have groups and conferences across the country. And so I think that that's going to be a challenge for some individuals who identify with that diagnosis and that label of Asperger's. That being said, I think what researchers across the country are trying to do by putting all of these categories that we knew from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 4 into the DSM-5, what we're trying to do is get better at identifying these individuals. And so it is unfortunate that it's going to cause some distress for some individuals who identify with these groups, but hopefully in the years to come it'll prove successful that we're better able to identify individuals, which would lead to better care.
The idea of identifying Asperger's tends to be higher functioning. They can find each other easier if they have that additional label.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and like I was saying, we've seen some individuals. You know, I know a number of young adults who've developed social groups based on that because they feel accepted and they feel mm-hmm. like they can talk freely about some of the issues that they face. And so that is one advantage, I think, for some individuals is having that acceptance and that peer group.
John in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Hannah Rue. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm curious. We talked a lot about behavioral interventions for people on the autism spectrum, and I'm curious what the research evidence-based practice might be as far as any pharmacological or complementary therapies that have shown to be at least show some promise.
That's a really good question, and we've seen research looking into evidence-based medicines. What we know right now is there have been three medications that have been identified from a couple of different research groups in the United States, which include things like Abilify, Methylphenidate, and Risperdal. So those are medications that have been identified to be evidence-based for individuals on the spectrum. In terms of complementary and alternative medications, we don't have a lot of evidence supporting some of those things. Take, for example, acupuncture, massage therapy, and things of that nature. There's no evidence supporting their use for individuals on the autism spectrum.
Has there been study of their use?
Yes, we do have studies looking at a whole wide variety of different interventions. That's one of the things about autism is because there is no cure. We see a lot of different things being tossed in the ring as possibilities for our treatments, and I think that's why it's really important for folks to attend to things like the National Standards Project, which we did at the National Autism Center, which focuses on teasing apart those treatments that have good empirical evidence to support them and those interventions or treatments that don't have scientific support.
Dr. Hannah Rue, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Dr. Hannah Rue, she's Executive Director of the National Autism Center. Welcome. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Ohio is a very nice place to live, but too many of the people who live here are unhealthy. In fact, the latest data from the United Health Foundation indicates that the Buckeye State ranks 40th out of 50 in terms of overall health. And the statistics are especially grim for the state's poor and rural southeastern counties. The Robert Woods Johnson Foundation ranked Scioto County least healthy of Ohio's 88. Joining us by phone from Scioto County is Scioto County Health Commissioner Dr. Aaron Adams. Welcome to the show, Dr. Adams.
Thank you very much. It's a wonderful day in southern Ohio. The sun is shining, the weather's warming up, and I think spring is on the way.
Well, you're just trying to rub it in now because it's rainy and kind of sort of crappy here now, but I'm happy for you. Joining us in the studio is Chief Medical Officer for the Ohio Department of Health, Dr. Andrew Wapner. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Adams, did it surprise you that Scioto County was ranked last in Ohio on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's latest health survey?
The information we have, and really didn't. We knew we were at the bottom last year with outcomes and health factors. So we formed the Sota County Health Coalition last year, which is a group of people in the community, health departments, hospital personnel, community leaders, citizens in the community to improve our county health rankings. We were pleased that we came up from 88th to 86th in the health factors. So we feel we're making some headway, but we realize this is a situation that takes time. And changing people's lifestyles, their way of thinking, their way of eating, their personal behaviors, smoking cessation, activities, will take us maybe a generation to see the overall improvement that we would like to see.
As a physician, what are some common conditions you deal with in your area?
I think when you look in an area like Sauter County, southeastern Ohio, Appalachian, general eastern Kentucky, and West Virginia is an underserved patient population with lack of education on how to prevent and promote wellness. We've geared healthcare toward the treatment of diseases turning into chronic diseases rather than how to delay the onset of these diseases and work on prevention. Diabetes, high blood pressure, lipid disorders with heart vascular disease, and cancer are just some of those examples.
To what extent, I mentioned at the outset that these are largely rural counties. Sauter County certainly is largely rural and poorer than average. Some of them the poorest in the state. What's the connection there, and do you have the resources, given that, to do what you want to do?
The resources are lacking. Healthcare situation in Sauter County is actually improving. We have Southern Ohio Medical Center. King's Daughters Medical Center of Ohio has moved in here within the last year and celebrated their first year, which is going to provide even more access to medical care and should help us with outcomes and quality care long term. Big problem we face in this region is a real lack of mental health care. We have a significantly addicted population, treatment options are not real great. We've gone from prescription drug crisis and pill mills here to a heroin epidemic at this point. So we have a problem, and we realize when we treat addiction and the complications that come with that, we have to come up with counseling. When I looked at the data for healthcare providers, we were well down there once again. We do not have enough mental health counselors here.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. We're talking about Ohio's struggles in some of its counties to improve the overall health with Dr. Andrew Wapner. He's Chief Medical Officer for the Ohio Department of Health, and also Dr. Aaron Adams. You've been hearing from Sauter County Health. He's the Sauter County Health Commissioner. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Wapner, you've spearheaded a new project called Ohio's Plan to Prevent and Reduce Chronic Disease. Tell us about that, and specifically what it does for a county like Sauter, where they're struggling with other issues.
Sure. Well, this effort was an effort that's been going on for more than a year, and has involved participants from more than 40 organizations across the state, from public health and healthcare to nonprofits to community organizations, advocacy organizations. And the goal has really been to develop a long-term plan, a cross-cutting plan, to look at how do we prevent and reduce chronic disease? How do we improve environments and policies and systems that encourage health and support health?
What do you think is one of the chief issues? I was just talking about diet with earlier, and that it really just goes back to the basics. But so many people in the rural areas, they don't have access to decent groceries. There's one county in Ohio that doesn't even have a grocery store.
Absolutely. And so, as Dr. Adams mentioned, there's absolute access issues in many parts of the state. And we always look at Appalachian Ohio as a place that has fewer resources in some ways across the board, healthcare resources, resources for healthy eating, physical activity, safe places to play. All of those situations exist both in rural settings and to separate different degrees also in urban settings too. And within each county, you certainly have populations that struggle more than others. And so this is an opportunity to take a look at some long-term outcomes where we'd like to see happen by 2020, but realizing that it has to start someplace. And that one of the most significant ways public health can address population health is by addressing the environments that people live in, work in, play in, go to school in, that can help support and encourage health, healthy decisions and healthy living.
Dr. Adams, down in Scioto County, do you find, do you think that the expansion of Medicaid, access to Medicaid, and also the additional access to health insurance is going to help a lot of people get treatment for these chronic conditions sooner before maybe they turn into chronic conditions?
We sure hope it does. What we've discovered in Scioto County, talking to people that work for different agencies like CareSource, that a lot of people are actually have been eligible for Medicaid and that sort of assistance, and they really have never gone to apply for it, were unaware of it, and then they show up in the hospital sick with a medical problem. Maybe somebody's had diabetes for 5 to 10 years and has had complications, let's say, for example. Then we help them access that through social services, but I think expanding the Medicaid system particularly help the children out there that are having difficulties and getting the right medical care and maybe their families to access that medical care. You know, we build cancer centers, we build heart centers, but we need to do more prevention. I think one of the things that we're trying to do here, and I'll branch to that, because I think it's really important, as health commissioner, I answer to the township trustees, the village mayors, and the commissioners. What we have done, we go to them. It's a policy that we've had through our Soda County Health Coalition. We use their facilities they have, their townships hall, their township halls. We encourage them to invite us out for health screenings, do mobile mammography, vascular screenings, any type of education that we can. Activities, maybe hikes or 5K, 1K, different type of activities that we can do and get to the people. We find that a lot of them are not coming to us as we'd hoped they would.
Dr. Wepner, children have always been eligible for Medicaid as they, as long as, you know, they're the requirements were lower for them than their parents. But does this overall attention to health care and health care coverage, has that hopefully made, as you bring more parents into the fold, their children will be healthier as well?
So, absolutely.
So, if mom can go to the doctor, more likely she's going to bring the kids along, and they're going to get to the doctor more likely.
So, you know, the interesting thing about health, health behaviors, and healthy living is it is a family affair. It's a community affair. It's all of us together. The more of us that do healthy things make an impression on the others. And that's especially true with children and with parents. So, helping parents manage and prevent chronic disease absolutely has benefits for kids, not just in having healthier parents, but also in establishing healthier habits earlier in life. And so increasing access to that for parents absolutely has an effect on kids, and hopefully in general just helps us build a culture of health and really help us create communities that can really support making the healthy choice as the easy choice.
Dr. Erin Adams, you talked about maybe taking a generation to have an impact on the smoking habits of people in Scioto County. Even with the even if the tax increase goes forward, you think that's still the case? And why a generation?
Well, as you look at the problems that we have in Scioto County, particularly with drug addiction, we're seeing generations of families, grandparents raising grandchildren, and even in a case I've seen, a great-grandparent raising great-grandchildren because of addiction with their children and grandchildren and so forth. So I think we have to reach the younger patient population. We're trying to go to the schools. I think the governor's policy start talking about the drug problem with the younger people is the way we've got to go. We've got to get schools. We've got to get education out there. To the young people, we got to teach people how to raise a garden, raise healthy food, things that would be great activities for them that would make them feel better about themselves, being successful in that capacity, plus learning how to do things for themselves, teach independence and decrease the dependence that they have, particularly for things like fast food, which are very powerful in this community because they're affordable.
Right. They're affordable. The fact is that the unemployment rates, it's one of the highest in the state. And we could just generalize and say in southeastern Ohio, the unemployment rates are the highest in the state. People don't have a lot to do. And the fact is the kids don't have a lot to look forward to.
It is. You know, we've got to get to the children. We learn with addiction. We've got to get to them before we get them to middle school and start reaching to them and showing them that there's hope, there's ways in life that they can succeed, particularly if they don't have that help within their own home. And unfortunately, that's the situation that's happened here. We've had a significant economic decline. This is referred to along the Ohio River as the Rust Belt. When I was a young kid growing up in this community, there were a lot of great jobs. We had a steel mill employing 3,000 people. The railroad was busy. An atomic energy plant in Piketon, Ohio. People had good jobs. People had opportunities. It's declined a lot. We don't have that economic growth and development here anymore. Part of what we've done with our Soda County Health Coalition, which we've done community assessment, community health improvement planning, but we're doing strategic planning beyond that, attempting to develop economic development in our community. Land reutilization, doing a lot of different things to improve the face of our community to attract people to come in here. So we have a lot on our plate, and there are a lot of people that have bought into improving the health and welfare of Scioto County. And we're happy because a handful of people can't accomplish that.
75% of Ohio's kids don't get enough exercise in general. Have you found that there's a higher percentage even in the counties like Scioto? Dr. Wepner, and to what extent does that have an effect on chronic disease?
Well, I think Dr. Adams is absolutely right. Is the younger we can start by having healthy habits by prevention, the more benefit we'll see in generations to come. Absolutely, physical activity specifically is an issue for lots of different populations, and it's the issues are different whether you're in an urban setting or metropolitan suburban setting versus an Appalachian setting. And having lived in practice in Appalachian, Ohio for 5 years, it's very easy to see how difficult it can be to get the recommended physical activity, especially in with families that have that live far distances from school, have to rely on busing, don't have access to the recreation facilities that may exist in other communities, don't have access to bike paths that may exist in other communities. So there's a lot of work that can be done. And I think one of the messages that Dr. Adams is hitting on really well is the power of collaboration. And it really does take leaders within the community, and it's not just health leaders, it's leaders in education, it's leaders in business, it's leaders in across the board to make these changes.
What about that mental health component that he brought up as so critical to overcoming a lot of these problems?
Well, we absolutely see higher burdens of chronic disease in the populations that struggle with mental health issues. So it's absolutely a priority population to improve access to the resources that population is going to need to prevent chronic disease and better manage chronic disease.
The economics, though, don't pan out. I mean, a place like Scioto County can't afford to just put up mental health care centers for all the people that need them. Where does the state come in?
I think that's a huge question that is certainly being addressed in terms of how healthcare is being given, what the integration between behavioral healthcare and physical healthcare to make sure that we're seeing people as whole people, and we're seeing mental illness as part of healthcare that we provide. And I think that's how Ohio is looking to move forward. It's chronic disease, mental health, these are big issues. And it takes more than just healthcare. It takes more than just government. It takes us all coming together to figure out where we can leverage our resources.
Dr. Aaron Adams, getting back to that mental health issue, it's not only that there's not enough access to it, it's expensive.
It's a problem. It's an uncovered service except for Medicaid. And,
right.
You know, we need to expand that out so we can deal with those issues. They've attempted to treat addiction. You know, counseling is just as important as the treatment that they're offering too. So, it's definitely an underserved situation that we're having here with that.
And do you see any light on the horizon, or right at this point, you're just getting together your coalition, and at this point, don't necessarily have any answers?
I think as we look here locally, we are getting more people that are elected to political office that can actually reach out and help us understand the problem, realize the economics in our county is holding us back. Our young families split up and leave here because of the lack of job opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I think as we collaborate, as been mentioned earlier in this, is the only way we can function. As a county health department, I can't take care of the third largest county square miles wise in the state of Ohio without collaborating.
Okay.
We do disaster planning here with the city health department, and we do everything together. If there's a problem in the city, the county comes in. If there's a problem in the county, he comes in, and we work together, whether it be flu planning or distribution of antivirals for the swine flu.
Okay.
Epidemic we had, or mass vaccination once that was available. It's collaboration is what we need to do.
Dr. Aaron Adams, Scioto County Health Commissioner, thanks for joining us. And Dr. Andrew Wapner, Chief Medical Officer for the Ohio Department of Health, thanks to you.
Thank you.